Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone. I have a pleasure to welcome you to another weekly EAN podcast. This time we will discuss a very complex topic of genetic testing and genetic counseling. My name is Anna Kostera-Pruszczyk. I'm a professor of neurology from Medical University of Warsaw in Poland. My team is also part of European Reference Network for Neuromuscular Diseases. And I have a pleasure to be with you today with Professor Maria Judith Molnar. Maria Judith Molnar is the Professor of Neurology and Clinical Genetics, Director of the Institute of Genomic Medicine and Rare Disorders at Semmelweis University, Budapest, Hungary. She also holds a number of very important tasks at EMA, and also she's a member of the muscle scientific panel of EAN. And also we have with us Professor Massimiliano Filosto from Neurology Department of Clinical and Experimental Sciences of University of Brescia in Italy. He is a director of the NIMO Brescia Clinical Center for Neuromuscular Diseases and also a representative of European Reference Network for Neuromuscular Diseases.
Massimiliano, would you like to start with telling us what is your view on the advantages, but also the disadvantages of the new generation genetic testing in neuromuscular diseases?
Yes, thank you, Anna, for your presentation. Neuromuscular diseases are mostly rare diseases. And the diagnosis for many of these diseases has always been based on clinical findings and pathological findings from muscle biopsy. For years, histochemical, histoenzymatic, immunohistochemical, and Western blood analysis have dominated the diagnostic scene in the field of neuromuscular disease. So the classical workup involved the usually clinical evaluation, muscle biopsy, and then the genetic study of individual genes in sangue with sangue sequences. Obviously, the diagnosis here was very poor in these cases. Now, the advent of new technologies in the genetic field are completely changing the diagnostic approach to neuromuscular diseases. The large NGS panels, the exome and genome sequencing have enabled a much higher diagnostic yield than in the past, increasing new diagnosis, the number of new diagnoses. Today, many neuromuscular diseases are investigated immediately after the clinical evaluation, directly by means of genetic analysis using a large NGS panel or exome sequencing, often in trio. That means we analyze proband plus parents. This latter type of analysis makes the subsequent evaluation of the identified variants and the genotype-phenotype correlation easier respect to the past. In Italy, for example, already several years ago, in 2016, a study from NIGO and other people from neuromuscular group, Italian neuromuscular group, published on neurology the use of a large NGS panel allowed to analyze more than 500 patients with no diagnosis, referred as being affected by limb-girdle muscular dystrophy or congenital myopathy, and to provide a complete molecular diagnosis in more than 200 cases. In recent years, this diagnosis yield has further increased. In 2022, a recent study by its corollary published in Brain studied neurogenetic diseases in consanguineous marriages in Turkey. A definitive molecular diagnosis could not be achieved before in these patients. About 200 patients, 200 children from more than 100 consanguineous families. All the patients in the study underwent deep phenotyping and trio whole exome sequencing, and then the data were integrated in advanced international bioinformatics platform. Then they detected the causative variants in more than 100 known disease genes in 72% of families. Therefore, the most important advantage in the new generation genetic test is that by using NGS and exome sequencing, absolutely the diagnosis yield in our rare diseases is by much increased. On the other side, despite this clear diagnosis advantage, a number of problems remain in our diagnosis process. The first, I believe the massive use of NGS, exome and genome sequencing, allows many more diagnoses than in the past. But a certain percentage of cases remain without diagnosis, despite the use of these technologies. Whole exome sequencing-based diagnosis of rare disease, diseases typically yields a 40%, 50% of success rate. Diagnosis of the patients with neuromuscular disorders has been also, in this specific setting, impaired by locus heterogeneity for the important phenotypic heterogeneity. And this is the first point. So the first point is that many diagnoses, many patients remain today still with no diagnosis. The second point is that genotype-phenotype relationships are often difficult. It's difficult also the assessment of the pathogenicity of the variants found by NGS, exome, and genome sequencing. In fact, many variants are often classified as VUS, or that means variants of uncertain significance, whose role remains doubtful in the pathogenesis of specific disease. As already I mentioned, the phenotype, use of prediction software, analysis of family segregation with the study of consanguineous family members, as for example in TU exome sequencing, can be of help in tackling these challenges. Today, in that cases, there are not diagnosed by NGS and exome sequencing, it is possible to use transcriptomics analysis. This is a new possibility in diagnosis our rare disease. Transcriptomics analysis can increase the success rate in the diagnostic process or genetic diagnostic process of our patients, because can individually discover some variants that often cause aberrant splicing. There is the cause of some kind of disease. This is RNA-seq. So RNA-seq, therefore, may confer additional advantages over exome sequencing. RNA-seq-based diagnosis of this disease can increase the diagnostic rate. It can provide also some pathogenic status information, which is not easily accessible through the normal exome analysis. Fourth, an advantage can be derived from integration of genetic analysis with protein analysis in the future, with proteomics. So, disadvantages of the pure genetic analysis by NGS, exome, and genome sequences can be reduced by an integration within studies on DNA, studies on RNA and proteins, and this can certainly lead to a further increase in diagnostic yield in the next future.
Yes, so we have more and more powerful tools, but there is a very important point in genetic testing. This is the moment when we pass the results of the testing to the patient, to the family, when we hope that this is the end of the diagnostic ESA and maybe the beginning of the proactive care, or let's say the option of introducing the patient into a very promising clinical trial. And this is a great challenge for the genetic counseling. So Judith, what are the challenges of the genetic counseling nowadays in face of the options that we use, that we have?
Thank you, Anna. I think it's an extremely important question. When we are talking about genetic testing, we have to talk about genetic counseling as well. which is the process of helping individuals and families understand and manage the risk associated with different genetic conditions. The clinical geneticists work with individuals and families to assess their genetic risk for different inherited disorders, and they provide information about testing and treatment options and offer emotional support and guidance. There are several general challenges. These are the following. The first, the complexity of the genetic information. Nowadays, the genetic information can be very complex and difficult for patients to understand, particularly for those who are not familiar in the medicine. We need to be able to communicate complex genetic concepts in a clear and understandable way to ensure that patients can make informed decisions about their healthcare. The second one is a psychological impact. Genetic testing can have a significant psychological impact on individuals and families, particularly if the results are unexpected or reveal a high risk for a genetic condition. We need to be able to provide emotional support and guidance to help patients and their families cope with the potential implication of the genetic testing. The third one is the ethical concern. Genetic concern raises important ethical considerations, such as concerns about privacy, confidentiality, and discrimination. We need to be aware of these issues and provide guidance to patients and their families to ensure that their rights are protected. In some countries, it's very difficult to access the genetic testing, especially in underserved areas. We need to be able to work with patients to identify appropriate testing options. And the last one, which I would like to mention, is the cultural and linguistic barrier. Genetic counseling may be challenging for those patients who come from different culture or linguistic backgrounds. We have to be sensitive to cultural differences and provide counseling that is tailored to an individual needs of each patient. Summarizing this, genetic counseling is a complex and challenging process that requires specialized training and expertise. We need to be able to communicate complex genetic information, provide emotional support and guidance, and address ethical and cultural considerations to ensure that patients receive the best possible care.
So there are many, many aspects of genetic counseling, not just providing the information on the diagnosis. But there is another question. In the older days, we used to go for genetic testing after the whole thorough workup. Is the increasing number of genetic tests available, but also the improved use that we have, the reasons that maybe in your opinion, we need special genetic counseling before the test is ordered, especially if we go for WES or whole genome sequencing?
Yes, the pre-test counseling is especially important. This is because in whole exome sequencing, we can identify a wide range of genetic variations, some of which may be clinically significant, while others may have uncertain or unknown clinical significance. So there are several key elements of the pre-test counseling. The first one is the special informed consent. Patients should be informed about the nature of the test, what types of genetic information will be obtained, and how the results may impact their healthcare and the healthcare of their family members as well. The second is the purpose of the testing. They have to understand what is the purpose of the test, why we need to do it. And this information has to include how the results may be used to diagnose a genetic condition or inform treatment decisions or provide information about the disease risk. Then the patient have to know the limitation of the testing. So they should be informed about all limitation, including its significance. For example, I mean the variant with unknown significance results, and the potential for false positive and false negative results as well. There are risks and benefits of a wide genetic testing, and these risks and benefits should be discussed, including the potential psychological impact of receiving positive or negative results, the potential benefits of early detection and treatment, and the potential risk of insurance discrimination, for example, or stigmatization. Then we have to give the chance to be able to decide what types of results the patients want to receive. I mean, decisions about reporting the secondary findings. Then, of course, we have to ask always patients about the family history. And we have to provide information about it that during the interpretation of the results of a whole exome sequencing, we can identify potential variants that may have been missed by previous genetic testing. And the last one is the follow-up. Patients should be informed about the potential need for follow-up care and genetic counseling, as well as the importance of sharing genetic information with different family members.
Yes, this is very important. And I think that those secondary or incidental findings, this is something that not only the patients and their families, but often the physicians are not prepared for. The information that we get when we ask for a little bit different question. How do you handle this in your everyday practice?
It's very important to make a definition. What is a secondary and what is an incidental finding? These are both types of different genetic variants that may be identified during the course of clinical genomic testing, but they differ in their relevance to the original clinical indication of testing. The distinction between incidental and secondary finding is important because the significance and implication of these findings are different. The secondary findings may have important implication for the patient's medical care and management. In contrast, incidental findings may be less directly relevant to the patient's medical care and may require additional evaluation and counseling to determine their significance. I can say some examples to be more understandable. For example, an incidental finding in genetic testing could be the identification of a genetic variant associated with an increased risk of a neurodegenerative disorder such as Alzheimer's disease in a patient who underwent testing for different reasons, such as to diagnose a genetic neuromuscular disorder. In this case, the identification of the Alzheimer's disease-associated variant may be unexpected and unrelated to the original indication for testing. However, the identification of this variant could have some implication for the patient's future healthcare management. An example from secondary finding, if a patient undergoes testing for a genetic neuromuscular disorder, and a secondary finding is the identification of a genetic variant associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. Here we can offer intervention for the patient. There are different guidelines. The American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics and the European Society of Human Genetics have both developed guidelines on reporting the secondary findings in clinical genomic testing. While there are some differences between these guidelines, there are also many similarities. Both guidelines recommend that laboratories have policies in place for reporting secondary findings to patients, and that patients should be informed about the potential for such findings to arise before testing takes place. The guidelines also provide recommendations for types of findings that should be reported, as well as the criteria for determining the significance of these findings.
So a very complex field that also needs the guidelines to keep up with the pace of development of the technologies. But looking back at the clinical setting of our patient, Massimiliano, what in your opinion is the role for muscle biopsy, biochemical analysis, muscle MRI, or other tests that we do to, let's say, better define the phenotype of the patient?
Oh, yes, this is a very important question, because as I already told you, the diagnosis yield rate is of genetic testing is between 30% and 70% in the different studies, depending on the technology applied. you have always to keep in mind that it is necessary to underline always the importance in this context of clinical evaluation, deep clinical evaluation, the so-called deep phenotyping, the importance of family history evaluation and the clinical genetics evaluation of consanguineous relatives, the segregation analysis. And in this context, the pathological and biochemical studies on muscle tissues or some other tissues can be very, very, very useful. A practical example, for example, you have to study the role of a VUS in a gene for muscle glycogenesis. You have a VUS and you don't know the role of these variants in the phenotype of these patients. So you can study the role of this VUS by evaluating, for example, the accumulation of glycogen on muscle biopsy, or evaluating the residual enzyme activity of that specific enzyme on muscle biopsy or in other tissue. And the same way, MRI can be very useful because it can show a specific distribution pattern and can be useful for a correct genotype-phenotype analysis to individuate some specific possible neuromuscular diagnosis. So I believe that the diagnosis of neuromuscular disease today should be based on the integration between the new omics technologies, genome, exome, NGS, transcriptomics, proteomics, and functional, histochemical, biochemical studies on tissue, muscle, or other tissues, other than, obviously, a deep phenotype evaluation. I think that this multidisciplinary approach and the constant relation and collaboration between the clinician, the geneticist, today are essential for obtaining a correct and conclusive diagnosis in such rare diseases as our neuromuscular diseases.
So still a great collaboration between clinicians and geneticists and discussion about how to plan the diagnosis and how to interpret the results that we have. Quite recently, we've seen a major breakthrough in the treatment for spinal muscular atrophy. Many countries have expanded their newborn screening programs with SMA to allow for the presymptomatic treatment. What do you feel about targeted genetic testing? Is it the era of the past? I believe there is still some place here also for everyday.
Yes, Anna. I think there is a place for targeted testing, absolutely. SMA is a clear example, as you already told you. But I think, yes, in many different specific situations, especially for those types of genetic abnormalities that are not easily detectable by massive gene sequencing techniques. For example, in diseases characterized by macro rearrangements, so deletion, duplication in PMP22 in patients with CMT1A, or deletions in patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, deletion is SMA, obviously, mitochondrial DNA deletions, abnormalities of the D4, Z4 region of chromosome 4, and the related epigenetic genetic markers in fatus camerosus muscular dystrophy. And of course, all the diseases due to dynamic mutation or those mutations caused by the expansion of existing polymorphic DNA repeat sequences, such as myotonic dystrophies, hereditary ataxias, etc. I think that in all this situation, a careful clinical evaluation can identify quite specific clinical signs typical of these conditions, even if not always pathognomonic, and lead to a targeted genetic analysis. So I think, yes, for targeted testing, there is still space in many, many specific cases, many kinds of variants of mutations.
Well, thank you. This will be also cost effective and probably will allow for a timely diagnosis. I believe that we are almost at the end of our time, but could you please comment, Judith, on the regulatory landscape of genetic testing in Europe? Is it universal? Is it what we expect it to be?
In general, genetic laws in Europe can refer to a variety of regulations and legislation related to genetics, including laws related to genetic testing, genetic research, genetic privacy, and genetic discrimination. Each European country has its own legal system and approach to regulating genetics. Some European countries, such as the UK, have specific genetic laws in place, such as genetic testing and screening programs regulation from 2006. Other countries, for example, Sweden and Norway, have broader laws that cover genetic testing and research, such as Genetic Integrity Act and the Biotechnology Act. And in Hungary, we have since 2008 the Genetic Act. This law sets forth the regulations for genetic testing, screening and counseling, and the research conducted in this field. It's important to note that not all European countries have the same laws, and the laws may differ in their scope, purpose, and enforcement. Therefore, it's important to research the specific laws and regulations in each country to understand their approach to genetic testing and research.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your experience on this complex and dynamically developing field. And thank all our listeners for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.